Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ashley Thompson and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Ashley Thompson.
With schools shutting down and the ways of daily life changing, children are hearing more about the new coronavirus. They may not fully understand it or know how seriously to take it, but their lives are affected. Many parents are trying to decide how to talk with their children about the virus and the outbreak. Some say they are checking in each day to see how their children are doing, but others worry that talking too much about it could make their children more nervous and fearful. Nicole Poponi is the mother of 10-year-old Clara and 12-year-old Jane. The family lives in Audubon, New Jersey. She said, "We talk a lot about it. I watch the news every morning, and they're always watching it too." Both girls said they have talked about the virus at school. Jane said her teachers have discussed it during science lessons. "I'm not really as scared of it. It's still not even that many people getting sick here," Jane said. "One of my friends is really scared of it, but she's honestly really scared of all diseases." Beth Young said she has decided to limit the conversations with her four children. They are ages 8, 10, 12, and 15. The family lives in Fort Mill, South Carolina. She said she does not want them to be afraid of getting sick, because kids get sick pretty often. And she does not want them to worry about dying. The new coronavirus causes a disease called COVID-19. For most people, including children, it results in only mild or moderate sickness, such as a temperature and cough. For others, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia, which affects a person's ability to breathe. Most people recover. The World Health Organization says that people with minor sickness recover in about 2 weeks. Those with a more serious case may take 3 to 6 weeks to recover. Child psychology experts advise parents and others to be calm and positive when discussing the issue with young people. They suggest centering discussions on active steps one can take. They also suggest doing research in order to answer children's questions truthfully. Dr. Jamie Howard is a psychologist at the nonprofit Child Mind Institute. She said it is important to reassure children, ask them if they have questions, and tell them how they can stay safe. The Institute and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention offer suggestions on talking with children. Some teachers and sports coaches are working to stop the idea that the virus is tied to any group or race. The new coronavirus first appeared in China. Some American adults are staying away from Chinese restaurants and businesses out of fear that they may get the virus. Seattle Public Schools in the state of Washington wrote on its website that misinformation has led to fear and anger. The school district's leaders urged students to combat racism and bias. "We are aware of reports that some of our Asian students have been targeted and discriminated against in connection to COVID-19, the school leaders wrote. "This is unacceptable." Parents should explain that measures such as wearing covers over your mouth and nose and closing schools are preventative and temporary, Dr. Howard said. She urges parents to follow what the television personality Mr. Rogers used to say. Look to the helpers to see what doctors, teachers, parents, and scientists are doing to keep them safe. I'm Ashley Thompson.
Wasima Khan stopped attending school 6 years ago. She has yet to complete her studies. The 19-year-old is not an exception. She is like many other young women in Nuh, where she lives in northern India. Only about 30% of the women there can read and write. That is about half the national average. Wasima Khan left school because she had to do housework and help her mother with younger brothers and sisters, she said. And there was no middle school in her community. At the same time, boys living in Pepika in Haryana state walk to the nearest high school, about 4 kilometers away. Yet, girls are not permitted to leave the small village.
In Pepika, many of the women work in fields or care for farm animals. Young girls get water while children play. Men often sit outside their homes in the sun after a cold winter. A group of young women from this mostly Muslim community made it to college by overcoming prejudices against women. Now they are working to get more girls into school. Every Sunday, they spread out in Pepika and other villages to talk to people about why they should let their daughters study. The young women persuaded Wasima Khan's mother to keep her younger daughter at school. They ease her concerns about dowries, the money or goods that a woman's family must give to her husband's family when they marry. She fears that educated girls will want to marry educated men who will demand a bigger dowry. This is difficult for many poor families who see no reason to educate girls.
Arashtun is a postgraduate student studying history. She says her college education has given her the strength to fight the dowry tradition. "I will only marry into a family which does not demand dowry," she said, "however well-to-do they may be." The young women tell Wasima Khan that she can return to school. As a girl, her goal had been to join India's police force. She does not know if she can go back, but she says she will do whatever she can to make sure her sister does not leave school. "I loved my classes," she said, "but I was helpless."
A nonprofit organization called the Selfie with Daughter Foundation is leading the campaign to empower and educate women in these villages. Its aim is to bring change by publicizing the success stories of girls who came from the villages and now serve as role models for other families. Rizwana Khan began her campaign by persuading her extended family to educate their daughters. She tells these women that educated girls could help the villages. In some areas, women are not permitted to interact with male lawyers, be taught by male teachers, or get treated by male doctors. Khan is training for a job in healthcare as a nurse. When she was a teenager, she became terribly sick, but her treatment was a problem. Her parents could not read, and medical centers in the area were very poor quality. It made her decide to get her own education.
Khan said she wants to bring medical aid to women in the area. This is a goal her father urged her to go for, even selling belongings to pay for her nursing school. They don't want to educate their daughters, but if women are ill, they want a lady doctor. "How will that happen?" Khan said. Another girl in the campaign, Shanaz Bano, wants to teach in a local school. She said, "I tell them that if your daughters don't attend schools, how will they find female teachers?" It is a message the young women repeat as they go from house to house. They point out how they had to fight with their families to get the right to study. Sometimes, even when parents agree to let them study, others in the village raised objections. Most boys who complete college move away to look for better jobs outside the villages. But the girls hope to use their skills and education in the community.
Anjum Islam is studying law. She wants to provide free legal aid to women. "I don't want to do that for men," she adds. But her bigger goal is to change minds. Here, men think that women are only meant to do housework and give birth to children, Islam said. "We have to change this thinking. If we have equality under the law, how can society have this gender discrimination?" The campaign is having success influencing some women. They do most of the work, both at home and in the fields. Aslima Khan is 30 years old. She is determined to educate her three daughters. She wants to make sure they can escape her life story of hard, backbreaking work. All day long, she works with the animals, finds firewood, cleans, cooks, and washes dishes, she said. "If I had studied, I would have been saved from this." I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ann Ball.
Thank you. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States entered the Second World War in December of 1941. Europe had already been at war since 1939, but the United States did not enter World War II until Japanese forces attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The attack was a surprise, but American military and political leaders had believed that the United States, sooner or later, would be pulled into the fighting, and they began to prepare for war. President Franklin Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson during World War I. He remembered how American troops were not ready for that war. Now that he was president, Roosevelt wanted to be sure that the United States would be ready when it had to fight. Throughout 1941, Roosevelt urged American industries to produce more weapons and other military supplies. He established new government agencies to work with industry to increase arms production. Some business leaders resisted Roosevelt's efforts. They felt there was no need to produce more arms while the United States was still at peace. But many others cooperated, and by the time Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the American economy was producing millions of guns and other weapons. Still, this was not enough to fight a war. After the Japanese attack, Roosevelt increased his demands on American industry. He called for 60,000 warplanes, 45,000 tanks, and 20,000 anti-aircraft guns. And he wanted all these within 1 year. A month after the Pearl Harbor raid, Roosevelt organized a special committee to direct military production. He created another group to help companies find men and women for defense work. And he established a new office where the nation's best scientists and engineers could work together to design new weapons. These new government organizations faced several problems. Sometimes factories produced too much of one product and not enough of another. Sometimes tools broke, and some business owners refused to accept government orders. But the weapons were produced, and American troops soon had the guns and supplies they needed. The federal government had to quickly expand its own workforce to meet war needs. Federal spending increased from $6 billion in 1940 to $89 billion in 1944. That was 15 times as much spending in just 5 years. Roosevelt had to take strong steps to get the money for all this spending. He put limits on wages. He increased income taxes to as much as 94% on portions of incomes over $200,000. And he asked the American people to lend money to the federal government. The people answered by purchasing almost $100 billion in war bonds. The great increase in public spending raised the threat of high inflation. Roosevelt created a special office with the power to control prices. Many Americans agreed with the idea of price controls, but every business wanted somebody else's prices controlled, not their own. Federal officials had to work hard to keep prices and supplies under control. They restricted how much meat, fuel, and other goods people could buy. The price control program generally worked. Its success kept the American economy strong to support the troops fighting in Europe and Asia. One reason these strong economic steps worked was because most of the American people fully supported the war effort.
She's the part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the riveter, keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little friend can do more than a myth can do. Rosie, the riveter, Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production lead, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie, the riveter.
You can look at photographs of people from those times and see in their faces how strongly they felt. In one picture from the state of North Carolina, a group of men are standing in front of old rubber tires. They are planning to give the tires to the Army to be fixed and used for military vehicles. Another photo shows a woman visiting a hospital. She is singing to a soldier to lift his spirits. Still another photo shows a man who owns a small food store. He is placing signs on meat and cans of food to tell people how much they are allowed to buy. You can also get an idea about the feelings of the times by the names of some of the popular songs during World War II. In addition to Rosie the Riveter, there were songs like Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. One of the most hopeful songs was this one, recorded by Britain's Vera Lynn. All Americans supported the war. A small number refused to fight because of religious or moral beliefs. They were known as conscientious objectors. And some Americans supported Adolf Hitler and other fascists. But almost everyone else wanted to win the war quickly and return to a normal life. Many Japanese Americans served with honor in the United States Armed Forces. But many Americans were suspicious of anyone whose family had come from Japan. They refused to trust even Japanese-American families who had lived in the United States for more than a century. Many banks refused to lend money to Japanese Americans. Many stores would not sell to them. The federal government relocated thousands of Japanese Americans in California and other states into internment camps. They were released only after the war ended. It was many years before the government officially apologized for mistreating Japanese Americans. But World War II did lead to progress for another group that was often the target of discrimination, Black Americans. Black leaders spoke out. They said it was unfair to fight a war for freedom in Europe while Black Americans did not have all the same freedoms as white citizens.
Negroes want the same things that white citizens possess. All of their rights, and no force under the sun can stem and block and stop this civil rights revolution which is now underway.
In 1941, a leader in the Black community, A. Philip Randolph, threatened to lead a giant march on Washington for civil rights for Blacks. President Roosevelt reacted by issuing an order that made it a crime to deny Blacks a chance for jobs in defense industries. He also ordered the armed forces to change some of their rules that discriminated against Black service members. Blacks made progress in the military and defense industries, but most other industries still refused to give them an equal chance. Major progress on civil rights would not come until the 1950s and 60s. Life was busy during the war years. There were many changes in the economy, business, music, race relations, and other areas. But in many ways, life continued as it always does. Americans did what they could during the hard years of World War II to keep life on the home front as normal as possible. But almost everyone understood that the first job was to support the troops overseas and win the war. This strength of purpose at home gave American soldiers the support they needed, and it also helped President Roosevelt as he negotiated with other world leaders. Diplomacy and foreign relations became much more complex during the war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.